OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, very happy to say on this evening's rugby slot, we have a brilliant guest, Sean Fitzpatrick, World Cup winner, All Black captain, 92 caps for the All Blacks, 9 Bledisloe Cups, 2 Tri Nations, 2 Super Rugby wins between 1986 and 1996, 63 consecutive test matches played and plenty more besides. Delighted he's made some time for us. Sean, how are you doing?
Pleasure. Nice to be here. I'm very well, thank you. We're sort of into week 7 of our lockdown here just outside London. And we're surviving.
You've been dragged here courtesy of Keith Wood. Hi, Keith.
Hiya, Joe. How are you doing? Fitzy, you're looking very skinny there, I have to say. You're looking very fit.
Oh, Woody. Woody, I'm saying I can't say the same about you, Woody. Yeah,
that's true, of course. I look at they can see me at the moment. I'm not at my fattest. Don't worry.
No, you look good. Good to see you.
Yeah.
So you mentioned London, Sean. That's home these days, is it?
It is. Yeah, I moved here in 2004 for a two-year overseas experience with my wife and our children, and we're still here. So we're enjoying it, and yeah, we still get back to New Zealand. We've got a place back there that we go back every Christmas, and then we come back up here. But all good.
Very good. And how do you feel your days when we're not in lockdown?
When we're not in lockdown, well, I still work for Sky. I do work for Sky. I do a lot of speaking, and I'm also the chairman of Laureus, which is a sporting academy that which takes up quite a bit of time. It's a charitable organisation too, where we use sport to change people's lives, and it's been going 20 years now. And I'm the chairman of the academy.
Excellent. Very good. Keith, talk to us about Sean Fitzpatrick. There'll be younger listeners hearing the resume and it will sound very impressive. You would have closely watched him growing up.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was...
That came out wrong. When you were slightly younger, I should rephrase.
No, I am significantly younger.
Though you look older, would it?
We're almost generationally different, Fitzy. And it was funny. I started as a scrum half, out half, when I was 12, 13. Obviously, with my body shape, that was never meant to be, and it was never going to be for an awful lot longer. But as soon as I went into hooker, you kind of have a look around, or who are the really good guys? They're great guys. We had an excellent Irish guy in Steve Smith. Stevie Smith was a big left-handed Ballymena man. Was pretty fantastic from an Irish context. But it was Fitzy. Fitzy set the world on fire. And there was a lot of other guys that were in around and all thought that they were kind of part and parcel of it. But Fitzy was so far head and shoulders ahead. And look, one of the things that I would have definitely followed is he scored a lot of tries from out on the wing. You know, and if any of the ones... No, the young people won't remember me either, Joe. But the ones in between would have known that I would have stayed out there for a few at times. But it was... he was just... On a different level, he changed it. Prior to that, the hookers were very small. They were tend to be short in stature, very wiry, very flexible. The striking and the striking against the head was probably coming almost to the end when Fitzy was there. Mm-hmm. The scrums were very, very low to the ground. They'd started to move up to kind of cater for slightly bigger guys. And he was the guy who broke the mold. So, look, I loved him. He was my hero. So it's kind of fun being on with this. And... look, I said it to you beforehand, Joe, and I think a couple of people might know this story, but you know, they say you should never meet your heroes. Well, on my first time to meet him, he didn't play the match in 97, and he was dressed in his number ones, and I thought it was a bit of a, I thought he was going to play, and even they never announced the team, or they announced another, I think, and I walked out in my tracksuit before the match in 97 in Lansdowne, and Fitzy's there in his number ones, and you know, you meet your hero and you're going to say something nice. Of course, I called him a gutless coward for not playing, you know. So, yeah, typical brash muppet of a young fellow. But I think you gave me a wide berth for a while after that, Fitzy.
I did.
Just, yeah.
I told Zinzan to get you.
Yeah, well, yes, which of course he did with Andrew Blowers. The Blowers in the same game. So I went off. I was in plaster at the end of that game.
Thank you, Woody. That's very kind, very complimentary. Yeah. It's ironic because I used to be a prop, actually. And I went to, I played for university when I left school, and Graham Henry was our coach. And we had a tight head prop at university called John Drake, who played in the World Cup final in 87.
Yeah.
And this was in 1982, 83. And Graham said to me, he said, "You're not big enough to be a tight head prop. We think you should be a hooker," and that's basically where it started, really. And John Drake used to play in France in the New Zealand summer, and he came back in 1984 and said, "Right, we're going to have three props in the front row, and this is the way we're going to scrummage." And you were quite right. He never let me strike for the opposition ball. And you're also quite right that I did play a lot on the wing.
Yes,
scored a lot of tries on the wing. And in 1993, we went to Britain, and I was involved in the selection of the team, but I gave them an opinion who I thought should be in the team. And with that, I went into a selection meeting, and Laurie Maines went, "We're going to take this young winger called Jeff Wilson on the tour to Britain at the end of the year, and we're not going to take John Kerwin." And I went, "Bloody hell, are you sure? He's one of our greats. It'd be great to have on the tour with Jeff Wilson." "No, he's not coming. He's not scoring enough tries." I thought, okay. So I said, "I want to be present when you drop him." And he said, "Okay." So with that, JK came into the bedroom, and we sat down. And Laurie went, "Sorry, John, but you're not going to Britain. We're taking young Jeff Wilson." And with that, JK said, "Okay, why am I not going?" He said, "Because you're not scoring enough tries." And with that, John Kerwin went, "Do you know why I'm not scoring enough tries, Laurie? Because that fat hooker of yours is standing on my wing, scoring all my tries," which is literally the case.
Yeah, no harm to bring down JK a little too. He was never shy of a bit of a confidence, was John, you know. And he was fantastic. But your Goldie became incredible afterwards.
He did, yeah. We had some great wingers, and you know, a year later was the launch of Jonah Lomu, also,
yeah,
the late Jonah, who we saw playing, and ironically, we saw him in 1993 also in Dunedin playing for the New Zealand schoolboys against the Australian schoolboys. In those days, they played before us, and with that, we arrived at the ground sort of an hour and a half before kickoff and watched 20 minutes of the schoolboys game. And the number eight for the schoolboys, New Zealand schoolboys, scored four tries off the back of the scrum. And we all went, "Who the bloody hell is that?" And they said, "That's one J Lomu." And within 9 months, he was playing on the wing for the All Blacks.
The same year, he played against Ireland. I think 92, they played against Ireland. He played number eight. Anthony Foley was number eight. And sadly, of course, both of them have passed on since then.
Yeah, you know, very sad.
Pretty hard, yeah. Sorry, Joe, we just got stuck in.
Sorry, Joe.
Continue on. The less I speak in this, the better. That is the MO for...
I'd probably rather hear a lot more from you, Joe, than Woody.
You're the one talking. I'm saying nothing at all.
Well, what struck me as you told that story, that's an interesting insight into your captaincy. So when a news like that has been delivered to a player, you wanted to be in the room.
Yeah, I wanted to. Yeah, I didn't agree with it. And I wanted to be there when Laurie told him. But you know, that's, you know, I think if you're going to make decisions like that, you've got to front up to it.
Tell us a bit about your captaincy and how you approached it and how you saw the role and how you performed the role.
Well, ironically, a year before that, I never thought I'd be an All Black captain, or I never thought I'd be an All Black to start with, and let alone to captain the All Blacks. And we had a disastrous tour to the World Cup in 91. And with that, we came back from the World Cup. We lost to Australia in the semi-final at Lansdowne Road. The game was over at half-time. They were much better than us, totally just outplayed us. And we went away from that, all of us, disappointed, obviously. I was 27 years old. I was going to go back to building houses. That was my job, a builder. And I was going to retire. And on the way home, we stopped in Sydney, my wife and I, having played Scotland in the playoff game on the Friday. Then on the way home, after watching Australia beat England in the final, on the Tuesday, we arrived in Sydney for a few days to let the dust settle in New Zealand, because they were pretty unhappy with the All Blacks. So we thought we'd take sort of refuge in Sydney for a few days. And on the back page of the Sydney Morning Herald was my opposite number, Philip Kearns. And he was holding the America's Cup in one hand and he had the Rugby World Cup in the other hand. And it said, the world's best hooker now becomes the world's best sailor. And I looked at her and I said, darling, I'm the best hooker in the world. And she went, no, you're a fat bugger. Literally. And we went home and I decided that I wanted to be an All Black again. Couldn't finish like this. And Laurie Maines called me in March of 92. And he said to me, would you like to be an All Black again, Sean? I'm the new All Black coach. And I said, Laurie, I'd love to be an All Black again. He said, well, you're probably not going to be. He said, firstly, you're too fat. Secondly, you're too slow. Thirdly, you're bloody arrogant. And the thing that hurt me most of all, he said, you've lost the respect of the All Black jersey. And with that was almost a changing of the guard, really. I stripped everything back to the bare boards. He said, I'll give you an opportunity in the All Black trials if you change. So I stripped everything back to the bare boards. Got as fit as I'd ever been. And with that, I got selected in the trials. And Mike Brewer was going to be the captain. He was Laurie, that was his man. And unfortunately, Mike got injured in the trials and there was literally no one else. A lot of my mates who I'd played with the previous years had been dropped and because they didn't change. And with that, there was literally no one else to be captain. And that's how I became captain. And I didn't really want to be captain. I was probably quite selfish. I just did my job really well. I didn't really transcend ages. I didn't really know about different cultures. But as captain, you had to learn all those things. And I always say to people, I had basically two blocks of my career, the first 6 years and the second 6 years. And without question, the second 6 years when I was captain, I was a much better player. I was fitter, faster, stronger than I'd ever been. I analysed the game better than I ever had. And most importantly, and this is what Laurie was trying to do, I was a much better person, without question. And that's what Laurie had done. He almost changed the face of the way All Blacks were selected. He wanted to select good people and then turn them into great All Blacks. And when you look at the current All Black team, I can name probably six people that when they started their career, they weren't great rugby players or good rugby players, but they were good people. And, you look at the current, the Ben Smiths, Ma Nonu, for example, is a classic example of somebody that turned into a great All Black. Never let the All Black jersey down and just being selected as a good people. Good people make great All Blacks. And I think that's the same in life, really, Woody, that, when people say to me, the All Blacks are humble, they act in a way that, honesty, integrity, respect, and that's the All Black way. But I say to people, no, that's a given. That's life. You should be humble. You should be a good person, those sort of things, but a lot of people don't. And I suppose in terms of the coronavirus, it's all about people. The only way we're going to survive this is through people. And one of the things I've loved and talking to you today, Woody, and meeting you, Joe, is reconnecting with people that we haven't spoken to for 5 years or, And I think we're lucky, Woody, in terms of the rugby fraternity. I don't see you for a year, but, straight away we're back into a bit of banter and a lot of people that don't have that luxury. And I think that's what I really have enjoyed about the time having this lockdown is connecting with people I don't normally connect with.
For me, one of the joys of stopping playing rugby was, look, I knew I had to stop when I stopped, and that was fine. But because I went into broadcasting with the BBC, it meant, A, I had another team, which was a really nice thing to have, because there's almost like withdrawal symptoms when you kind of, you step away from your team. But also you get to re-engage with people that you would have fought with on the field or you know, competed with against on the team. And there is that shared heritage that you have. It becomes very easy. Like it was fantastic at the World Cup, meeting up at the World Cup and kind of bumping into all the different guys from different places, which was pretty fantastic.
I was a bit sick of Heineken by the end of it though, Woody.
Well, you drank enough of it, Fitzy, you know, which was, there was no harm in that either. But it was for me, there was a kind of a difference. There was a lot of the guys who'd retired, like I'm retired 17 years now. So you're retired plus another six, five or six. 22, yeah.
22
and those guys weren't, I felt, didn't want to be out every night. The meet whenever they could, dinners and that group, which made it for a pretty fantastic time. There was one thing I don't know if you knew, when you retired, when you got injured in 97, Graham Henry gave me a call and said, Woody, any chance are you coming down and playing for Auckland instead of Fitzy?
Oh, really?
And I was playing for Harlequins at the time, and I said, you know what, anything I can do to make that happen. And when do you need me? It'll only be for a short period of time. When do you need me? When can I do it? And it was over the Five Nations. And so it wasn't going to happen. And Graham was trying to convince me that, look, it would be really good for your rugby and it might benefit our... Yeah, I said, I don't think I'm going to have that argument with the IRFU to let me off the Five Nations for one.
Yeah.
But and it was one of the things I did want to do, was actually to try and play down there if I could at some stage, but that was never to be.
No.
Sean, that's a hell of an intervention and a hell of a phone call on Laurie Mayne's behalf. And to use the line, you know, you're World Cup winner, you've lost respect for the New Zealand jersey. Did that register with you as a total out of the blue shock? I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Or on some level, did you recognize there was a truth in it?
That was a benefit that I did recognize that. We've gone through a really amazing time at for the club rugby, then playing for Auckland, and then playing for the All Blacks. You know, we had 14 All Blacks through sort of 87, 88, 89 in the All Blacks basically, and we, no one could beat us. We were beating teams at ease, and with that, we just became a bit arrogant. And you know, we always talk about you need to be arrogant to be successful with a degree of humility, but leave it on the field. And in 1991, we took that arrogance off the field. And going to Lansdowne Road, traditionally the Irish have loved the All Blacks. They love the Australians more than us, dare I say it. And you could sense that. And yeah, Kearnsy had come into the Australian team in 89, and I used to eat him up and spit him out for bloody breakfast. And little did I know, he was getting better and better. And I'd always be chipping away at him, and he'd never say anything back. He'd just sit there, do his job. And I don't know, there was a game in 1990 in Wellington, which is the first game we'd lost since 1987, and 86 actually. And with that, Kearnsy scored a try around the front of the line-out. And with that, he stood up, scored the try, and I was lying on the ground at his feet. And with that, he gave me a two-finger salute. And people said, what did he say to you? I said, oh, he's invited me to a barbecue and offered me two sausages. But that was the turning point, really, for them. And they went on, and they had an amazing era from sort of 90, when they won the World Cup, they were head and shoulders above the rest of the world in terms of the way they played rugby. And I literally didn't realise it until my wife said to me, you know, you're a fat bugger. And I had, I've just taken my position for granted. And with that, you know, I'd never analysed the opposition, never really analysed Kearnsy. And with that, they'd actually overtaken us. And it was the same with the number of the players in the All Blacks at that time.
You said there you never thought you would have been an All Black. You were. Were you not hot stuff coming through? No.
No, I was quite large as a boy, and in New Zealand, I started playing rugby when I was 4 and a half, pleading with my mother because I was the youngest of 4 children, and you know, Dad and my brother used to head off to the rugby club every Saturday morning, and all I wanted to do was just play rugby. But unfortunately, being a big boy, you hop on a set of scales, and whatever weight you were, that was a team you played in. So at 4 and a half, I hopped on the set of scales, and with that, the man looked, I can still remember, he looked at it and he looked at me, and he said, "Oh my God." He said, "You need to go over there and you're on that team." And I was basically playing with 12-year-olds. So it wasn't a lot of fun. And this was the case right through. I had natural ability. And like you, Woody, I thought I was a number 10. So that didn't last very long. And then I got thrown right into the front. And right at secondary school, I played in the worst rugby team at the school because that was the team that was a restricted weight. You had to be under 10 stone. I was 13 and a half stone. And the man said, "Sorry, you're 12 years old and you've got to play open grade rugby," which is massive. They're the big boys. They're the 18-year-olds with beards and those sort of things, kissing their children as they run into the field, that sort of stuff. And with that, I went home and told Mum, and she burst into tears and rang the principal of the school and said, "No, he can get dispensation because he's only 12 years. He can play in the third grade." But it was the worst team at the school.
What was she feeding you? You're like a baby elephant here.
What's that?
What was she feeding you? You're like a baby elephant or something.
I was the youngest. Lots of bread and that potatoes and good Irish family. It wasn't until I was about 16. I made a representative team when I was 16, and I had natural ability, but I didn't really take it too seriously. I did all the things you shouldn't do, and it wasn't until I went to play for university that Graham Henry's, basically said to me, "One day you could be an All Black if you drank a little less, smoked a little less," and that was literally the turning point when I was 20 years old. I made the under 21s at 19, and that was basically it, really.
Wow, amazing.
It's probably quite a good thing though, Joe, and I don't know about you, Woody, but I, because I was large, I played every sport. My father said to me, "Son, I don't care what sport you play, just enjoy what you do." And Dad had been an All Black also. So obviously he never pushed me to play rugby. He was happy with me playing any sport really, which was probably a major benefit in terms of my longevity. That was probably something that, I try to encourage all kids, be the best you can be, but make sure you enjoy yourself. You don't have to play rugby. If you want to play football or you want to be a hurler or whatever, just get out there and enjoy it.
Mine was kind of the flip of that, which is kind of funny, because my dad had played for Ireland as well, which was interesting. He died when I was very young, but I was too small. And it was funny, I was scrum half and I just didn't like it. 12, 13, I didn't like it. I was trying to get in and out to school, which was about 12, 13 miles. I was late in the evening. I said, "I'm giving it up. And I'm going back to playing hurling," and I would play hurling and soccer instead. It was only suddenly... there's the hurdy. I like it.
Fitzy. Oh, I like it.
For radio viewers, that is it's a Maori hurley, is it?
Yeah, look at that. Bit of All Black on that.
Look at that.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Bit of an amazing Belfast.
That's very impressive, yeah. And for all the listeners, you'll be able to see that up on our webpage afterwards, I presume, Joe.
Yes.
But I gave it up and didn't start again until I was 16. I just started getting big enough then again. And still thinking I was a back, of course. And they said, "Yeah, no, you're not. You're in the front row." And again, I didn't, it was when you hear kids saying, "Yeah, when I grow up, I want to play for my country," or whatever. That was never a dream for me.
No.
I wanted to play sport. I loved sports. It didn't matter what the sport was. You went and played it. And it suddenly kind of accelerated at 17, 18 when I joined Carry On. When I left Munchens, I loved the last year in Munchens, but when I left St. Munchens and went to Carry On, it suddenly just accelerated these things. I kind of grew into a body or whatever it was, and then suddenly these things kind of become a reality. But I would have been a late developer. And I think you end up having a great sense of industry because you take very little for granted. Because of that fact, it was never a star 12 or 13 or 14, you know.
No.
Sean, I saw a quote from you when you win the 1987 World Cup, you're back in work on the Monday.
Yeah.
So obviously this is a very different era. This is pre-professionalism. Were you working away for the bulk of your All Black career, or when you get to a certain level, did you kind of not have to work so much?
I think initially, definitely pre-sort of 91 World Cup, we all had jobs basically, which I think has been a great thing. We ironically back in New Zealand, where we live in New Zealand, two of my colleagues, Steve McDowell and Craig Dowd, actually live within a mile of where we live at the beach, and ironically, so I see a bit of Stevie and I'm always, because we have a reunion with the All Blacks once a year. We don't have individual team reunions. You just get invited. Well, this year has been cancelled, obviously, but it was going to be before the Wales test in Dunedin, I think it was, where every All Black gets invited. And it's the coaches, the physios, the managers, they all get invited. You get three tickets to the game the following day, but you have to go to the dinner. And then the All Black captains meet on the Friday for lunch. There's about 35 living All Black captains. We meet the current All Black captain comes and talks to us, the coach, which is a fantastic event. But what's nice is that you probably have 250 past All Blacks that come to these reunions just to, and yes, me, as I'm getting a bit older, the older ones are sort of dying off, but you still see some of your childhood heroes, which I absolutely love. Seeing that, and you see the next generation coming through, and I've forgotten what the question was, Joe.
It started off with you being in work on the Monday.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, right. Most of us worked, and Stevie and I were having this discussion last Christmas because I like learning and finding out what the rest of the guys are doing and that they're okay. And I'd say 100% of the guys I played with have all done really well, and whatever they've done, they've been successful in it. I'm not talking about making money, but they're all employed. Woody, in terms of your generation, I don't see a stockpile of rugby players. I think even now, when you play professional rugby, at the end of your career, you are going to have to work. I think even today, so
yeah,
most if they've got their head screwed on, most current players are preparing for life after rugby. I suppose just the way we did, it was less of an issue for us because we'd all had a profession.
Yeah, I think it is one of the tricky parts of the game. So for me, it was half and half, half amateur, half professional. And I remember using up all my holidays when I was working in the bank to go to play for Ireland at 20 years of age, and you'd have to go on you'd meet up on a Wednesday before the match on the Saturday. You'd train on Wednesday afternoon. So I'd have to take a half day on Wednesday and trying to negotiate representative leave so that you'd continue to go and play. But I think it became hard for a period of time. A lot of guys thought that, yeah, they'd do really well and then they'd start again. But actually, if you're not preparing, yeah, there is a gap and there's a fear factor for two or three years. And I think it's tough for different groups of guys where they're used to a level of income or they're used to being famous or being known. But that's not a job. Being famous isn't a job. It just means they know you when you come in the door. You have to do a job when you go in the door. Yeah. So I still think there's an awful lot of work that has to be done with that just to look after the guys because you don't want to fall off at the end of it. But I do think the crossover between your and my generation of rugby, we'd all worked. So I worked all the way through my rugby career because actually I found it relaxing. was a great way to kind of take your mind off the game on a Saturday, was to try and have a few meetings on the Thursday or Friday.
It's quite strange. Like in 95 or 96, we went from earning nothing to earning $300,000 a year. And yeah. I can always remember John Hart, and we're probably lucky that he came in as coach in 96. He said to us, he said, right, you're earning all this money, but you are going to live off $45,000 a year. Literally. He said, right, the rest of the money you put into savings and we'll organise people. But it was great advice. And we're going to continue to work. But I can always remember we'd train early in the morning, and I was working for Coca-Cola in those days. And I'd train, go home, shower, hop in the car to drive down to Coca-Cola. And with that, as I'm turning left to go on the motorway, up pulls next to me in this brand new sponsored car, Carlos Spencer. And on the back of his brand new car, he had a jet ski. He was heading off to the West Coast beach. And I was like, wow, I'm doing something wrong here, I think. But
Something I absolutely wanted to get your thoughts on. The 95 World Cup is interesting and memorable for about a gazillion reasons. Everything from, you know, John Olomou's emergence into superstar and how exciting it was for the game, to the food poisoning before the final and the, you know, the rumors afterwards and everything. But really what I'd love to get your memories of is the formalities of the final. Pre-match, I don't know to what extent you remember post-match, maybe you get off the pitch, but we always look at it through a South African prism, you know, because of what Mandela did, and it was so iconic, and there's PNR, yeah. And he's out in the jersey, and the plane flying over the stadium, all this stuff. I haven't, I must say, thought about it too much from your perspective, and what it felt to be like the potential party poopers. I guess players try and block a lot of that stuff out. You can't be looking over at Mandela. And yet I think as well, how can you not? So do you remember it all that well?
I do. I remember it well. And obviously during this lockdown period, I've done quite a few podcasts and shows like this. And that's probably the number one question. You know, what was the Mandela World Cup like? And for me, it was a life-changing experience without question. I'd never experienced anything like that. I don't think we could have prepared any better than that. But I still look back on that. You know, I'm a bit of an anorak like this. I always think about in failure, if I'd done things differently, would the result been different? And yeah, I look back at that World Cup. It was the greatest World Cup I'd ever been to as a player. And you know, I wanted to play South Africa in the final. From the moment we arrived, you know, I can remember Louis Lates, who was the president of South African rugby at that time. He'd been very, very involved with New Zealand rugby through the sort of the apartheid times, and you know, we were the last nation to compete with them, and then we were the first nation back in there after the breakdown of apartheid. And he came up to me at the start of the World Cup, and he said, "Sean, all I want is for the All Blacks to play the Springboks in the final, and I would do everything humanly possible to make this happen." And literally he did, and we were treated superbly, and you know, we were fit. Laurie Mains had said to us in 92 that we need to be the fittest and fastest team in the world to win the World Cup in South Africa. You know, we're going to play this high tempo game. We're going to have not a huge forward pack. We're going to have a fit, fast forward pack that delivers quick ball, and then we're going to spread it wide to our nippy wingers, Jeff Wilson and Eric Rush. And with that, Rushy got injured, and we had this other winger called Joan Lomu, who wasn't fit enough to go to the World Cup, but he got pulled off the plane that was going to Japan. We didn't know he had a kidney disorder. He couldn't load fitness, and he just couldn't keep up, so he got thrown off to the sevens, put back into the team. And with that high tempo game, you know, we just tore the world apart. They'd never seen an attack like that. There was no defensive systems. So we went through the World Cup rated probably number five in the world when we went to the World Cup in 95. We'd lost to France the previous year in a series, first time ever at home. So no one really gave us a chance. So we were sort of under the radar. We played Ireland, played Wales, played Scotland in the quarterfinal, played England in the semi-final, which really sort of made everyone aware that we were potentially, you know, world champions. And it literally changed from that moment onward. And I sort of wished it of, I wanted to immerse the team in the atmosphere of Johannesburg for that week, which is probably the worst decision we ever made. You know, we couldn't go anywhere. Jonah had just turned into this global superstar. And ironically, he'll be, you know, I say now that he's the only global superstar we've had, and I think he'll be the only global star we'll ever have. Just the impact he had on that World Cup. And literally in the space of 3-4 games, he'd turned into this megastar. And with that, we were being harassed the whole time, you know, with car alarms going off in the car parks. We had phone calls during the night. You'd go down to breakfast because we said we're going to eat with the public in terms of the restaurants. And with that, you know, you go to breakfast. I'm Fitzpatrick. We are going to kill you on Saturday. And, you know, yeah, thank you very much. Nice. Have a good day. You know, all this sort of stuff. And then on Thursday, we said, right, that's it. We're going into lockdown. We're going to take ourselves away. We'll eat in our own team room, which ironically was probably the worst thing we'd ever done. And on the Friday morning, I think 16 of the 21 of us couldn't get out of bed with diarrhea and vomiting. And by Saturday, it was, you know, most of us were 100%. We were ready to go. We were prepared. I think Jeff Wilson was the only one that was still being sick. But everyone else was fine. And then being at that stadium, and as I said, it's just like it was yesterday when Mandela walked down that stadium into, you know, 65,000, you know, very passionate South Africans, just chanting Madiba, Madiba, Madiba. And the power that filled the stadium with it, wearing Francois' jersey, just will live with me forever. And I think it, you know, ultimately it was probably the difference. And, you know, right till the, you know, the final whistle, we were all tied up. Went into extra time, and even in extra time, I thought we were okay. I thought, you know, we had the firepower to beat them. But ironically, it's just, you know, it was down to that one kick of Joel Stransky, which cost us the game. And, you know, in real time, 2 minutes before the final whistle, Andrew Mertens, our number 10, missed a, you know, drop kick by that much. So, but, you know, for me personally, it's, you know, I would love to have won that game. But when I think what that did, and Woody and I, we were both in Tokyo last year at Yokohama Stadium, and what that did to a nation. You know, I'm wearing a sweatshirt at the moment, and it says "Sport unites us," and that's what it's done. And South Africa is a glaring example of how sport can unite a nation. And when I went home that day in '95, back to our hotel in Sandton. And we drove out of the stadium down the street, and there was a black man, a white man dancing down the street together, celebrating the success of what, you know, South Africa had achieved in that final. You know, we were with Francois in Tokyo, and he said, Fitzy, he said, 95 was unbelievable. He said, what this World Cup win has done for a nation, you will never see anything like this. And when you look back, when Sia took the Khaleesi took the trophy around South Africa, just mind blowing how that had united that country.
Yeah,
but yeah, I still would have liked to have won. Let's make that quite clear. And I ironically, I've never, even in this lockdown period, I've watched a lot of old games. You know, I love watching old games of, you know, the 77 All Blacks or the Lions of, you know, in that early time. But I still have not watched the 95 World Cup final.
It's I've never seen it.
Have you not? No.
Kickoff was happening, I was going under the knife. I got injured against Japan in Bloemfontein.
Right.
A couple of weeks, a few weeks beforehand. And I never saw it. And because I never saw it at the time, I said I'd never watch it.
Well, whatever you do, don't watch Invictus. I still haven't watched that either. I can't.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. Yeah,
I can't believe that they have. You know, they have Matt Damon playing Francois, and then I still can't recognise who played me. Is it some little cat?
You were only incidental in it, Fitzy. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
I don't think it was a speaking role, unfortunately. Sorry about that. Are you a fan of where the game has gone? I know Keith wanted to get into that a bit before we let you go. Do you enjoy the modern version of rugby and what it focuses on and the types of games it produces?
Yeah, I am. I'm a real fan of rugby or sport, but I love watching rugby. People say to me, do you miss not playing? I said, I so do not miss playing. I had 12 years, had a fantastic time. It was the most important thing in my life. But now, we've got two daughters and we all love going to watch the All Blacks play around the world. Going to the World Cup last year, going on Lions tours. We love that. I enjoy watching it. Having watched these games back in the early 80s and 70s, the game today is a much better game to watch, I can assure you of that. We're in for a realignment, I think, in terms of where rugby's going. The financial model's not right, and Woody, you can talk more eloquently about that than me, but I'm a little bit concerned about where it's going. Because, as we say in the All Blacks, the way we're doing it today is not good enough to win tomorrow. And, I think one of the benefits of the lockdown, and as horrible as it is, it's going to force the hand of the way we do business in all fronts, in terms of the way that rugby is, in terms of, what's going to happen over the summer if it does come back. And I'm talking the Southern Hemisphere summer. We could have tours to New Zealand over Christmas, or Australia, is it a bad thing? And it's interesting reading the press at the moment, and if you read the New Zealand papers, with the chairmanship of World Rugby remaining with Bill Beaumont, and whether you like that or you don't, New Zealand's obviously very much wants change. And the divide, Woody's probably going to get bigger now between the south and the north again.
Yeah, I think it's almost too broad to fully go over it now. But it's for me, the drive for rugby to be global has always been an issue for me, because rugby's a complicated game, and we need to maximise, in my view, what we have and to make the most out of it, and to try and make it as fair as we can, which of course we need to do. And to try and look after good teams that are coming through the system. But at the moment, we seem to be too fractured. And actually, when there's pressure on, people are hoarding as they need to. But we have to figure out exactly what expansion means to us. There's one part of the game I wanted to ask you, and it was because of one of those ludicrous statistics or facts. Warren Gatland sat on the bench for you. Was it 47 times or 37 times?
57.
Did you ever think, he never got capped, did you ever think of giving a sucker an even break? Did you ever think of letting him on at any stage?
Believe it or not, Gats and I, I think we're quite good mates. But you look back now, I think if you look back now and think, why wouldn't I have given him an opportunity? It just wasn't the way it was done in those days. And the coaches had no ability to drag you off. I'd be playing with broken ribs and teeth hanging out. And there was no way I was going to come off. And that's, because Gats was a good hooker too.
Yeah.
And that was probably half of my thinking. I don't want to give Gats a chance because he. And it was the same with Norm Hewitt. Norm was an outstanding player. But that's, for me, was, and that's, I'm sure the motivating factor to my longevity was being pushed the whole way.
But so I would look at that and that point and say, I think that level of no subs being when I started, there was no subs either. So at that point, I think that's wrong. But I actually also think having 7 or 8 subs sitting in there chopping and changing, I think that's equally wrong. Yeah. Is there a way that we can rebalance that? Can we bring it back to being a little bit less so that you're not on this power athletes that play for 20, 25 minutes?
Well, you look at what happened even at the World Cup last year. Some of the best players in the teams were on the bench. and would come on in the last 20 minutes as game changers, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. There's an argument to saying that it creates better rugby. And it's maybe a safety factor. You could say that either way, actually.
Yeah.
You talk about scrums. That's still a major issue for me. The time that we waste. I actually watched the Lions' first test in 2009 against South Africa. And the number of scrums that were collapsed, reset. Australia versus England. I believe I might even watch that game. The number of scrums, just unbelievably bad.
But I looked at 2001 Lions against Australia, and the referee blew the whistle, and there'd be a scrum within about 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Bang, in you go, ball in, out, gone. Yeah. There was a few collapse, but not a huge amount.
Right.
It now seems to take 2 or 3 minutes to have every scrum. That has to change. Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely has to change.
Just speed it up. Sorry, Joe, we're rambling.
No. It's two grumpy men here. Great about the scrum. I love it. It's exactly. It's like I'm at the All Blacks reunion dinner. It's exactly what they'll be talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was amazing. If you look at those old games, how quickly, even when I was playing, in 86, literally, you'd be forming up as you ran into getting up for the ruck, basically.
So what's changed that? Is it just coaching and getting technique perfect and all that stuff?
I think it was a safety issue.
Yeah.
We used to just to smash in. And that's where a lot of the injuries came, was when, kids were pulling out in the last second. I think what they've done is much safer, which is so necessary.
Okay. Well, listen, we've kept you for more than long enough. Thanks so much for checking in. It's been great to go down memory lane and get your thoughts on the game now. And I suppose stay safe over the next couple of weeks, months, beyond.
Well, I'm actually going to go out and practice a bit of hurling, actually.
No, you can't use that, though.
Why not?
Because you couldn't damage that. That's too beautiful for you to
use. I'll use that side.
Yeah. Are you living anywhere close to Zinni?
Thankfully, he's about 10 miles away.
Okay, because he is the worst hurler of all.
Oh, really?
And gets unbelievably cranky over the fact he can't hit the ball. So
he would have tried too, I'd imagine.
He did. He tried too much out in a field at the back of Windsor somewhere, yeah.
Very good, Woody.
Thanks again, great Keith, to see
thank you. Nice to see you too.
Thanks a million. Mind yourself. Yes. Hi to all the family.
Okay, you too, mate. See you, Joe.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.